Disclaimer, this content is meant for information only and not as a diagnosis or medical treatment for any condition. If you or a loved one needs help, please seek out a qualified medical professional for assistance. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Katie Oshta, BSN, RN, IBCLC, and Infant Feeding Specialist. Quench your thirst for knowledge and travel with me across the nation to discover, learn, collaborate, and better serve clients from all over the globe. Let's ride and thrive together. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Jimmy Chan, a graduate of the University of British Columbia, Faculty of Dentistry. Dr. Chan has a keen interest in the high-tech aspects of dentistry to improve and enhance the well-being of his patients. Dr. Chan holds fellowship status in both the Academy of Laser Dentistry and the Institute of Advanced Laser Dentistry. Dr. Chan is a co-founder and current board member of ICAP, the International Consortium of Oral Anglophrenia Professionals, and a past board member of IATP, International Affiliation of Tongue Tie Professionals. He is an active member of the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, the American Academy of Periodontology, the Academy of Laser Dentistry, the Chinese Canadian Dental Society of British Columbia, and the Canadian Dental Association. Dr. Chan has cared for patients in his family dental practice in Lynn Valley, North Vancouver, for over 25 years. He collaborates extensively with lactation consultants, midwives, manual therapists in his community to improve the lives of breastfeeding dyads. He gives back to his alma mater by volunteering annually for the UBC Alumni Association. Please welcome Dr. Jimmy Chan to the podcast.
Thank you so much for allowing me to come and see you today, Dr. Chan. I'm excited to be here. So I want to talk about how you got started. I mean, how did you kind of get into this whole phrenectomy world?
Well, thank you very much for having me today, sir. I'll review the podcast. My name is Dr. Jimmy Chan. It's out here in North Vancouver, BC, lovely Canada. And I started off from my journey here when it comes to helping breastfeeding dads. When I had attended an Academy of Laser Dentistry in Oslo, France, many, many years ago. And I was attending a seminar that was held by Dr. Larry Kotlow. He's a pediatric dentist from Albany, New York. And it was fascinating what he was showing us, how he was using this dental lasers for treating newborn babies. I had asked audience if there's anyone that's interested in doing this, please, here's a list. Please sign your name on there, because he couldn't do it all himself.
Right. Yeah, I met with Dr. Kotlow last year. He's still pretty busy with them. Been doing them a long time.
So I did sign up, and I made sure that the lasers I had were compatible with the procedure that he was suggesting. Obviously, there was a fair bit of training that was involved, like he came to this presentation. So I felt pretty comfortable offering it as an option for families that came to check me out. Now, I didn't do any advertising. There wasn't something that I know that this is their doing. And then Dr. Kotlow, I imagine, spoken with her, people contacts him from our area here about looking for a provider, and I think got brought up.
Yeah, it's definitely a growing field, but I mean, I will say Dr. Kotlow kind of did, I feel like, in the modern sense, start all of this movement. I mean, I think he said he started doing them in 1976. Like, he's been doing them a long time.
Well, but not with laser.
No, not with lasers back then.
Using lasers for the burden of that case. So I considered him like a door. I connected with over the years at each of the category of laser dentistry conferences. Of course, supporting a lot of the other unfiled conferences and seminars occurred since then. It's great to have someone like Larry, Dr. Kotlow, ask questions or the big mentor that I also tried to have that on as well. Since I connected with a lot of people and try to encourage them to learn more about what we do for their babies.
I was thinking about how we used to really focus on their release. Mm-hmm. As kind of the center of everything. And, even when I started learning, it was like, okay, I see a tongue tie, go get a release and everything will be better. right? And I'm happy to see the evolution of how we're all learning that that doesn't usually actually lead to a good result, that we need more treatment, and obviously more treatment the older the person is, right? But that's a big part of it, is understanding the team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm fortunate to have started off about 1 year ago when we first that was pretty much drilled into me. That was already something that was, you know, part of the whole process, is that it should be almost like a triad. C1, 2, 3, triad, where it'd be the lactation consultant to start with to do the initial assessment because of problems with the nursing and feeding, and then to send the manual therapist, such as the chiropractor, creative sacral therapist, or an osteopath to help tension and resolve things without surgery. Okay. And then have that such enough with just lactation and the being a therapist. One of the things don't seem to improve, you know, quite so ideally. That's what we call the early providers, which is still and just after someone can provide in certain parts of the world, but midwives can do that as well. And those practitioners now,
right?
Also, like since your versions, not what comes to the world. So, I've always been indoctrinated that triplets, that I always encourage parents to consider that. I don't make it a rule, say, where I'm not going to do it with procedure. If you don't go ahead with this, it's also like the parents are even the ones that, you know, they're the ones that make the final decision,
right?
You know, other children's well being. And but I would encourage the children to do the best they can to involve your ideal group.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely, it's hard to have hard and fast rules, right? It's hard to make a rule that you can apply to every single family, because no families are the same. No babies are the same, and all families have different, kind of come in with different issues, different abilities, different time frames, right? You know, that was one thing that when I started learning too, I was like, okay, everyone should always have it. This is the right way. And that's something that I've learned as well, is that we have to have a lot more flexibility, and it's beneficial, definitely. But, you know, everyone has their own path, and all you can do is educate and give an informed consent, but you can't force.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's, we learned that just by practicing on the dentist and local practice dentistry, but practice everything. Because, you know, human beings are very different, you know, one to the other. So we do get a modded orange, you know, after practicing so long. And so that way we actually be flexible about how to approach things when we found your patient, you know, in the clinician care. So it's, I really enjoyed doing this part of my practice, for breeding connected use and our practice. That's, it's something that's very rewarding and allows me to learn utilize technology that I've invested in towards things that are really will help some more every state to get started. Again, after a child being able to defeat, I will need properly to set them up for a learning.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't have hard and fast rules, but there are a couple of cases where I will really highly encourage families to wait. One of mine is when a baby's not gaining. And so that while I know that they may transfer more immediately post-phrenectomy, a lot of babies don't. Some babies get really stressed out. So, you know, I usually caution parents that let's take anywhere from a couple of days to a week and really supplement however we need to. There are lots of different ways to help a baby gain, but that putting a baby that's already in a stress state through a phrenectomy can be tough. The other one I don't like is when they have like a very severe torticollis, when they've got a real big asymmetry. They're just typically not going to get, I mean, you probably know this better than I do, but it's harder to see and get a very even release when they're really tight on one side and very loose on the other. So
you should be tricked or et cetera. And I guess the question is, who is going to identify that? You know, and whose responsibility is it to direct them to the right, you know, healthcare provider to address things of that nature? And obviously, I don't have any training in body work and in label therapy, nor do I have any formal training in oil issue. So I was always taught or told that the lactation is the general contractor. Okay.
Right.
First, well, okay, this is in the bowel, let's go ahead and see this person. And then, that works, that's great. And then, let's move on to the next place and the healthcare provider to help with those issues there. So I'm very fortunate to have many very knowledgeable, sometimes savvy, and also body work savvy lactation consultants or area that I can afford to plug.
That makes a huge difference. Right.
Not all areas have those resources.
No, and that's something I'll tell people too, is that really there's no profession, because they'll say, well, my pediatrician didn't notice a tongue tie, or the ENT said it doesn't have one. I will tell people, even lactation consultants, even dentists, like there are still plenty of people out there who are not, super great at tongue tie across the board on professions, because it's not something that's taught. It's something that we learn after our licensing, right? So everyone has specialties, is what I generally try to tell people, that everyone has specialties. I don't really do inducing lactation or twins. Those are kind of two that I just don't have a whole lot of experience with it. I've walked a couple of clients through inducing lactation for either adoption or maybe a partner is carrying the baby and they want to lactate, but it's just not something I have a lot of experience with. So when it comes up, generally I'll say I could, but I know someone who's really great at this. They'll have more resources, more training, more experience. How about if I connect you with them, right? Because we can't specialize in everything. It's just, it's hard to know everything. And so it's important to know your limits. And I'm happy to refer for certain things and say, look, this is just not something I do, And I've had a handful of twins in the last couple of years, all because they had ties. And I, again, sent the parents on all of them. I don't really do multiples. I don't have a huge toolbox for you, but I do tongue tie. So it's totally up to you, and a couple of them chose to find someone who did both, which was really great for them. And a couple of them said, no, what we really need isn't someone with the twins experience. We've got that. We need someone with the tongue tie experience. So, I've done it, but I think it's important to know our boundaries too.
And so where I draw the line typically is when people are asking each other doing plantar releases on their children.
Yeah.
And there's noticeably lots of issues going on, or it's second release, right? Oh, it's been released before, and without really seeing a lot of good events to release again. And I don't do functional frenuloplasties, right? That's taught by doctor.
Zombie?
So, yes. Yeah. So I do have a colleague, somebody that do them quite frequently. So same thing, someone who has more of those tools in their toolbox that can help them be older kids. I'm happy to treat infants all day, every day, because they don't have to get sutures and understand their tongues there.
What age limit do you like? Like, what is your comfort zone?
I don't say no to anything in terms of age, but ultimately, it's nice to be able to treat babies under the age of 6 months. Right? Beyond that, and there's a lot that needs to be unraveled because there's also so much compensation that's occurred, and parents will just need to be prepared that, hey, we're not going to see a lot of improvements, or it'll be very slow, like that's improvement leading to involve a lot more other healthcare providers to help with that. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of unraveling that needs to be happening there. Preferably, even within the first 3 months, would be ideal when it comes to connecting these children to try to improve breastfeeding.
Yeah. So I do know of other colleagues that literally after 2 or 3 months, they really don't see different needs at all. Yeah. So,
everyone has their own comfort zone, and I've been a little more flexible just because there was a certain point in time where there weren't a lot of providers that were offering this as a service, or if there was, it would be to the medical profession, there would be a big, wait for the two releases to be done. So thankfully, there are more providers in my community in this area that are doing it. There's quite a bit of interest now. I got in relatively early, 11, 12 years ago,
learned about this. And so that's a segue here. My I have an interest in promoting what I know and in this community through some of the organizations that I've helped to start up. So I'm not sure if you're aware of ICAP. So ICAP is ICAP. It stands for the International Consortium of Oral Ankylofrenula Professionals.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are a couple of these organizations that, that exist. It was sort of a, we came from another organization known as IETP. Okay.
Right. That was started in 2009.
Yeah. Dr. Kotlow, yeah, Jean Rakow, and Kathy Wasagena, and many others that were involved at that time. So yeah, that was a organization that I was asked to be on the board of directors of, and did that for a couple of years before some of us from IETP decided to create a different organization with a slightly different vision and purpose there, that we felt very strongly about. And so that was ICAP. And so ICAP, we've been around for a couple of years now. I think our first conference was back in 2018 in Toronto. And we recently had one in Vancouver last year, in 2022. Now, I had a bit of a break during COVID.
Yeah.
And did a virtual conference back in 2021. But yeah, and our next conference will be coming up in Cleveland, Ohio, next year.
The next one should appear. When to Cleveland.
I've never been to Cleveland, and I think we wanted to involve people on the East Coast there.
Yeah.
And sort of in the middle, and Toronto, and all just on the West Coast, and Vancouver. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to be in May, beginning of May, May 1st to the 4th. That's 2024.
Nice. Yeah. Actually, Jennifer is who I would definitely consider my mentor. I'm taking her. She has a holistic lactation course. It's a year-long residency program, and I'm a month in right now. And then next July, I'll be in Connecticut with her and Lenny Kendall and Michael Geit, the osteopath, and Sharon Vallone. It's the night managers usually put them for a week, being in person and again learning everything from all of them. They're just excellent professionals and excellent teachers. So I'm lucky for that. Yeah. You know, and learning is just my passion. Right. There's just, it's like this rabbit hole. It's like the more you start to understand, the more you realize that you just want to know more, you just want more resources and more tools.
And I find that's going to these conferences that are held by, well, obviously individuals and professionals who are very passionate about what we do. Yeah, there's so much sharing involved, you know, and to be able to connect with the greater community and be able to be, you know, connect with people outside of your boundaries and your borders. And it's so liberating and refreshing to just realize that, hey, you know, all of us, you know, have these issues. You know, every single, you know, country will have, you know, families that are struggling, you know, to deal with, you know, feeding their kids, their babies. And there's certainly a shared commonality that way. So, you know, it's taken me to many different places around the world. I went to a Leadership League conference in Paris. I went one year and listened to Dr. Kotlow present there, as well as others. That was very illuminating to see it with a slightly different perspective of breastfeeding from the Leadership League. But it does this next. And that's the great thing about international conferences.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not just, you know, North America centric or US or Canada centric. It really, you know, brings people from all around the world to connect. And that's why we, you know, as an ICAP, feel that, you know, it's very important to encourage that, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, a lot of these conferences then you tend to be more in North America.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely helpful to get perspective, right? To get out of our little box of, this is the way it always is in our area. And so it can be really beneficial to get that wider lens. Yeah. With babies, with regard to the age thing, yeah, I've seen providers that will do all ages. I've seen providers that will do just like adjustment with Dr. Thomas in Bellevue. And he's 3 months. 3 months is his cutoff. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Yazzie went down to 7 months. He was going to do 3, and a lot of us got on him and said, the problem with 3 months is between 3 and 4 months is really what I describe as a perfect storm. You have, at least in the US, you have a lot of moms returning to work. So there's a big shift between pumping and stuff. So we have a lot of times we will have a decrease in supply anyway, whether it's related to that or not. But we also have a shift in maternal supply by 12 weeks where it was very hormonal based, and now it's much more supply and demand based. So at around 3 months, it's very common even if mom's not returning to work to see a drop in supply if we have an unaddressed hemtype, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was living off the letdown. We also have a huge shift in feeding reflexes, that suck reflex, that brooding, that seek and gape, those get integrated primarily. And you can't get a 3-month-old to just suck on your finger the way you can a 3-week-old, right? And then there's even physical changes in the baby's face. Their oral anatomy is enlarged. They have more airway space and they have more oral cavity space than they did in the first couple of weeks of life, which a lot of times makes them struggle more with bottle or struggle more with breast, that things they could do initially, they cannot do, right? And so 3 to 4 months is, it's just the number one time I see family. You know, a lot of families I will see in the first 2 weeks of life when things have been really hard very quickly, but so many families, so many tongue-tied families, it was, and I say this in quotes because I don't believe it's ever a just, but they'll say, well, it was just my pain. The baby was doing fine, right? The baby was gaining, right? They're what sometimes we refer to as the fat, birdie, fussy baby, those babies that were gaining, but really kind of colicky, gassy. But again, a lot of times those parents are told the baby's perfectly fine. They're gaining. They're doing fine. Keep going. Those babies, a lot of times fall apart between 3 and 4 months. It's a very common age for things to really kind of come to a head. So that's an age where I send a lot of babies off for ectomy between 3 and 4 months. It's a much better age. I feel like 4 to 5 months gets really hard. That tends to be a real peak of distraction, right? You get those really distracted babies that can't nurse during the day. Sometimes they're all over the place looking at everything. So that can be a real crazy age. And then they start moving and things get, you know, they definitely get more complex the older that baby gets, especially release-wise for you, right? I mean, it's different on a 6-week-old and a 6-month-old. Those are very different babies. Very different.
It all depends on how many assistants you have available to assist. And I think you had brought up earlier about whether or not to have parents in the room or not. And, you know, again, this is where everyone's going to have their routine and what their comfort level is. And you know, some providers I hear, you know, insist that the parents be involved in, you know, holding down their child or restraining their child. And that they make it a rule because they don't have enough, you know, hands to have that happen otherwise. So I much prefer not to have the parents involved, just because it's already stressful and traumatic enough for them to have the procedure done for their child, let alone being the one to have to hold down your child. I get every you know, healthcare provider, every provider will have their way of, you know, making that happen or not, you know. So yeah.
I do find that it can be very traumatic. I mean, when I hear from parents, especially the people who reach out to me post-release, who, you know, they had a release, they thought everything was going to be great, it wasn't, and then they reach out a couple of weeks later, a very common thing I hear is how, you know, they went into the appointment kind of not totally knowing what to expect. And it's like, you know, a lot of them will literally say it's like their brain shut off and all of a sudden they've got a baby in their arms crying and bleeding. And they were super overwhelmed. And those are the parents not in the room, right? Like, I can't even imagine the emotional trauma of adding that, especially to a new postpartum parent when we're talking about the hormones, that shift, the just the intense connection there. Right? That's just got to be an awful lot. So yeah, I generally always tell parents, prepare to not be in the room. It's better not to. It's going to be hard enough as it is, right? You know, and I tell them I watched my kids, but my kids were much older. They were 13 and 10. It was a different thing. And if I wasn't a professional doing this, I still wouldn't have watched it. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't something as a mom I needed to see. It was something as a professional I wanted to see.
We even tell parents you have the option of waiting in the waiting area or out in the hallway where you will need me within earshot.
Right.
Because even, you know, just hearing, you know, your child sigh, you know, that can, you know, bring upon, you know, emotions that are yeah. So thankfully, yeah, we do have a little bit of distance waiting, or sometimes I'll even say, oh, just, you know, go to the washroom. You know, by the time you come back, you know, from the washroom, we'll be all done. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, it can be really hard to hear your baby crying. Mm-hmm. And then it turns into the debate of whether you're numbing or not, mm-hmm. because that turns into whether or not the baby can coordinate to suck or not immediately afterwards. And like, if a mom's hearing baby cry, mom might even have this floor spot. She might let down, right? And she might want to nurse that baby right after. And the problem with that is a lot of these babies, if they're numbed, which I'm not saying it's wrong choice, I don't have an opinion. I think mm-hmm. the choice should be between the release provider and the parents. I truly don't have an opinion on whether or not to numb. But if they were numbed, then they a lot of times can't coordinate to suck, right? And so then you have that added in. So yeah, hearing that baby cry and all of that, just that's a lot. But holding your baby during a release would be really hard too.
There was one provider who is, I'm sure, is an excellent doing a huge service for all the families in this community. But I remember this is years back at a conference, like, oh yes, I put all the babies in a car seat and insist that they do the car seat while they're doing the procedure. Like, that's like a passive restraint of sorts, right? That not bad. And again, maybe there was a certain way of doing it, but again, this is where many ways of going about doing it. Some, we use this wheel models in our practice, or actually we use the papoose board. Okay, so we have multiple different papoose boards, from Washington State, made by natives, and they're great because they're past restraints that similar to the petty wraps, they're out there as well. But we just like the fact that they're easy to clean and some different sizes, and they're soft, for the most part. And with head of obliges for the older kids. I think as long as whatever it takes to do the procedure safely and do it quickly, okay, so that we're not, prolonging any unnecessary procedure time, that would be, family's best interest, So I typically tell parents it'll take about 5 minutes. Will it take 5 minutes procedure, but I mean, it's, their mind isn't that long, right?
Didn't
it? 5 minutes, I thought it'd be a lot longer. Well, 5 minutes. And then of course, give them out for free and like, wow, it's even faster. What's happening that one?
Yeah, I have a client going tomorrow. Well, when I said 5 minutes, she's like, are they cutting for 5 minutes? No. I said, but there's things to do. They're going to take the baby back. They're going to wrap the baby in a swaddle so they're safe. Like you just said, all those things. And when I explained how long the actual procedure was, she was like, oh, okay. I feel okay with it. Like it is a pretty short procedure with a lot of times very profound result for these babies. It's a big deal. And, it's interesting to me how we start to take one piece and it becomes more common, like the tongue tie. It's like, okay, we're kind of getting there on that. But then there's still like a little bit of controversy on the lip or like the bigger controversy on the buckles, right? Like we still haven't gone all the way. And so it's an interesting kind of thing. But I always tell parents, first of all, with the lip, I see a lot more discomfort.
Ooh.
That's where I see the really colicky, fussy, gassy babies. They're just not sealing and they're getting air in. And those are the symptoms usually related to the lip. Right? Is that really fussy, gassy, you can't put them down, they're cranky, right? And the bottom line though, to me, is if you've got a restriction that's affecting function, it should be released, whether it's one or six. It doesn't matter. It matters if it's affecting function. So, I think it's an interesting thing though that we still kind of debate each one.
And I would add symptoms to the list, because of course function is paramount, right? Can't feed, then can't thrive, right? But if you have symptoms, like yourself, the symptoms can drive you crazy as well, right? And the last, of course, in parents. Well, I'll tell parents, so this is a three criteria. But the appearance is the least out of the three.
Right.
Interestingly, outside of our community, what we do in terms of providers, other healthcare providers will focus on the appearance. The medical professionals, I don't see a ton. So, and his forehead has no problem.
Yeah. And there have been some that I can barely see that I'm like, I know that based on the function I'm seeing, the symptoms I'm seeing, it's there, but I can barely see this, right? But it doesn't matter. That's why I don't do a lot of percents restricted. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will say, well, what percent is this? And I'm like, it doesn't matter if it's 90 or if it's 10.
Right.
What matters is that this human has functional loss. So if they have functional loss, then we should help to get rid of the functional loss, whether that starts and ends with exercises and body work or whether we need to bring in a release. It doesn't matter, but it's about that function. And I would say too, if you've got symptoms, you've got functional loss, right? Like if we're really gassy and colicky and everything else, we're going to have functional loss, whether that's in our lip seal, our cheek strings, our, even tongue cupping, we might be losing that breast with each suck. Lateralization, like it's in there somewhere in that function, and that's that's what gets me too, is that the dichotomy of a release provider is the diagnosed, but they're not looking at function, right? Because you're not trained in function. Mm-hmm. Especially in the US, that's the way it's looked at, is that the release provider diagnoses, like, I don't have the legal right to diagnose, which is fine, but it's this back and forth of like, well, what criteria are we using to diagnose that? Because if we're putting it all on a release provider, then we're saying we're only diagnosing based on anatomy or symptoms, not on function.
So we rely on the referring source, right? So it's a midwife or lactation consultant referring to us. We've, as a provider, we'll have assumed, you know, that there has been an assessment done, a functional assessment done to, you know, determine that, okay, this child is needed to function in this way, and therefore, hence the referral to us, right, as the provider. And then that's when we, you know, provide the diagnosis. Okay, right, they can see what this is, the concern for function, there are all the things that was ticked off on the intake form. Take a look at it. So, you know, inside, just add that last final, you know, check, more for interest than anything else. Because, you know, just saying, you have kids that have, you know, huge problems with a very minimal appearing tie, and then kids that have middle problems that have significant ties. And then, you know, kids that have no problems at all have significant ties, right? So appearance is really where it trips up a lot of people who aren't using the functional and symptomatic, you know, criteria for assessment. So I really appreciate all the lactation consultants and midwives that have done the extra, you know, learning and training to identify with these, you know, potential problems and then make the referrals to us.
Yeah, it's a confusing thing that there are some that you look at and they're like, oh my gosh, obvious, and yet they seem to be functioning fine. And those are ones that will wait. You know, a lot of times with those clients, they'll say, okay, let's check in 2 weeks or 4 weeks, right? These are the things we're watching for. These are the things that might clue us in of what's going on, right? But we'll wait and see, because we're really not supposed to be releasing on anatomy alone,
well, right? And here's where I do appreciate the referrals I do get from one of the fellow dentists, pediatric dentists and medical doctors, and they're learning, you know, just like many people are, how to properly assess and when to refer. And typically, yeah, I mean, the appearance is certainly there, right? But they don't always have issues with function and symptoms and so on. So we do have many parents that are relieved. Okay, well, in that case, I'll opt not to do anything about it because my child's doing, right? So, you know, are they compensating? The answer probably is yes. Okay. Because, you know, you have potentially a type 4, and this is the Cotlow classification, type 4 tile, which is typically an anterior tongue tie. Well, you know, it does, it potentially will limit your tongue, you know, a little bit to a certain degree. But at what point does that manifest itself as being a problem, right? And yeah, these are all sort of philosophical questions, where it's like, well, how much compensation is too much compensation? How much compensation do you want your child to have to go through in life, you know, to expend this sort of unconscious energy to try to deal with, as opposed to, well, let's make that call and release it, okay, though we're having problems earlier on, so that way we can prevent issues from happening. So that is the thing that I will always tell parents that, you know, when they ask me, oh, now we want to do this as a preventative, you know, measure. And I'm like, well, if you're asking me for advice, I don't have a crystal ball. There's no way for me or anyone else for that matter to be able to tell you that, oh, by looking inside your child's mouth, we'll see what it's seeing, and we can predict that your child will have speech impediments, issues with eating solids or liquids, having any sleep disturbances, sleep apnea, issues with breathing, issues with dental or orthodontic issues. You have no way that I can tell this, but, you know, looking in your 2 week old child's mouth, that any of these things will occur. That being said, if we do have a problem with nursing and you are interested in moving ahead with having this procedure done to release the ties for feeding improvements, that, you know, it might make sense that we're also lowering the risk of future issues from happening, right? Because when you have a greater range of motion, then you should be able to accomplish whatever you want, right? You should be able to make whatever sounds you want to make, you know, hopefully and make form whatever words and string whatever sentences, right? So that's a speech concern. Well, fingers crossed, likely lower in the list. Yeah, but there's no one-to-one correlation. There's no way that we can say, okay, 100% certainty that's, you know, by doing this sci-fi release for your child because they're having problems nursing, that your child will never, ever have a speech impediment, right? To date, I don't think there's been anyone else that's come back to me and said, oh my gosh, Dr. Chen, he kind of said, you know, my child will never have a speech impediment. and we did the release, and yet, you know, here we go. We're having to see a speech therapist, right? So, you know, these are all things that are, there's no way that we can guarantee. No. But thankfully, we haven't had a lot of those, which are rewards.
But I think the one that I tell parents is still definitely on the table is the palate issues.
Okay.
That's what I'm seeing. It's like we're doing the release, we're getting good function, we're at a good point. Mm-hmm. And as we, you know, usually verbal, typically I'll see clients at 3 or 4 weeks post-release, and we'll, you know, if we're at a good function point, we'll kind of wrap up there. But I'll tell them these are the things to watch for, right? We'll look for open mouth, whether it's mouth breathing during the day or open mouth posture at night. We're looking at that palate. And a lot of times, depending upon how the palate looks, a lot of times I'm telling them just, you know what, let's connect you to an airway orthodontist and check in when the kid's 3 or 4, right? Because one consult might help either get you on an early road or help reassuring you that everything's moving along. You know, and long-term breastfeeding does widen that palate. Body work does widen that palate. There's still a lot of things they can do. But, and the tongue itself, just, you know, tongue is a super strong muscle, right? If the tongue is in the right spot, it's going to hold in that palate. But some of these kids, these bubble cathedral palates, like even if the tongue is up there as high as it can go, it still can't reach the whole palate. So, you know, that's the one that I will tell them that we're still going to be on the watch for this, because it just, it's something that we need to watch out for, you know. And some kiddos, it's fine. And other kids, it's just, they're going to need to start this early road, especially the kids I see later. I've had a handful of others, so like 1 to 2 year olds in the last year. And those are definitely ones where, like, just connect with an airway orthodontist, get a consult early. You know, it's not fun to do palate expansion. I had my 10-year-old had to go through that. But I was glad that we found out about it when we did, because if we had waited, you know, girls, the maturity in their oral cavity happens earlier and everything, we might have been in that category of a whole different ballgame. You know, you lose out on some of that growth. So it's definitely better on the early side, but it is so hard to predict, you know. Babies have a short list of symptoms, right? They have that short list of, like, you know, weight gain and colic and reflux and these short lists. But when you get into older children and adults, the symptoms can be so varied, so varied. And I find it really, really in a lot of ways, so interesting how dynamic our tongue and our oral cavity is for our whole body, right? Like, you think it was Jesse Whitcroft in Colorado, he said his were all sinus stuff. He had 4 or 5 sinus surgeries and he kept needing to have them done. And they kept saying, well, we don't know what's going on. And he had his finally went down that oral rabbit hole and had his tongue released. And he said he's never had another nasal surgery and it had been like 10 years. I know people where it's been more body stuff, right? Migraine or body tension. My older daughter, during her release, her right foot felt different. Like during the release, I was waiting for mine. I didn't get one. I was sitting there going, where's my moment? I want to feel different. I want all the tension gone in my body. Didn't work. Mine's been a much slower progression because I had mine released almost a year ago now. Last December with Maggie Davis at Florida Tongue Tie in the Tampa area. And it was a great release. It just, I didn't get any aha moments of like, oh, things are all better. We all want that, but it rarely happens. You know, but I do think the symptoms can be so varied as an adult. Like, I wound up actually choosing to have my release at that point because I developed really horrible reflux post-COVID last summer. I got COVID, and a lot of people, you know, COVID kind of throws our system all these underlying things. And now I can look back and say I had reflux for a long time. It just wasn't terrible. I always had to drink a lot with meals, always had to clear my throat after meals, always felt like there was something there and I was swallowing, but it was low level and it was constant in my normal. So I just didn't think anything of it. But post COVID, it got to the point where I could not lay down for about a month. And, you know, doing slippery elm and then deglycerinated licorice and different things, and they all helped. But I was like, they got to do something. This is, it's been long enough. It's been, my body's gone through this enough. But it was interesting to see the ebb and flow, because when I look back over, like, for example, if I look at Richard's symptom list, right, Alabama tongue tie, and you look at the adult one, I've got like pretty much every check mark through my childhood. But then in early adulthood, I really feel like a lot of the symptoms kind of went away. And then I feel like a lot of them were coming back. So it's interesting. And it, that's not necessarily a path that anybody else will follow, right? I'm not saying that that's how it is for adults. I'm just saying that was my path. But it was definitely interesting to look at it and go, I had ebbs and flows where I definitely could see more symptoms and more functional loss. And then times where my body compensated better, but it was always still compensating. You know, the compensations are going to be there if you don't have the range of motion, really, and the function in terms of strength, endurance, mobility, all of it, right? So it was very interesting for me to go through my own recipes, because I think it gave me perspective. I mean, obviously it's different with a baby, but still gave me some perspective. Definitely one of the most profound things I found was I was doing my own functional therapy for about 3 months before him, 2-3 months. And I thought I was in a really good place, right? I could hold cave that they talk about, hold my tongue up for, I got to over 2 minutes. Just, you know, I was in a really good place, kind of really good release. I previously, before my release, could lift up my tongue and clean my front teeth, right? Just kind of do that. It was a little tight, but I could do it. Post-release, I couldn't do it for about 3 weeks. I was really surprised. I didn't expect to have kind of a functional loss that long. And it's one of the things that I talk about with parents is that why we do those oral exercises. It's why we work on increasing function before release. Because if you take a baby that has very minimal function, that's really struggling, and they have released, and they're one somebody who bites backwards first, right? They can end up in kind of a really stressful, dangerous territory, you know? So it increasing function before the release is really beneficial for everybody.
And that's the take-home message, really. That it's, I mean, it's not about the release. It's about, you know, the release is just one part of it. To do a release without considering everything else is, can be dangerous, you know? And that's what I'd like me to help share in terms of that message. That, you know, we do have individuals out there that promoting having, you know, installed lasers and getting this, you know, learning more this procedure, being able to, you know, do more dentistry, right? With more of these oral surgery procedures, and telling these dentists that, yeah, you can offer this, the added chain of a service to service the pediatric community. But, you know, without proper training and understanding about what is it you're actually doing, how are you going to manage all of this, it's and not connecting with the community that exists already, and being sort of a lone wolf. That tends to be, we're so isolating. And when I first started doing this, it was somewhat scary, as well, I'd never done, you know, I'm entirely so before, but having people that, you know, as mentors that will answer questions, that made all the difference. So yeah, I like to think that for our organization, ICAP, who we will have Richard Baxter, you know, speak at actually that next year, as well as Robin Merkel Walsh, speech therapist, actually one of our board of directors as well, you know, to have people that have been doing this for a very long time to be able to mentor and teach and train other writers that are new to the community. But I think that's a really big, important thing. Can't learn about this from a textbook and expect a big one to be able to it. Or on YouTube, for that matter.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this world we got, it's YouTube or social media for lots of instruction.
Yeah, I definitely think there are some providers who are popping up all over the country, but all over the world. They're just, you know, they're definitely riding the bandwagon, and they're, you know, very tongue-tie friendly and offices and all this type of stuff. But a lot of them are not practicing within a team, or it doesn't have to be in one office. You know, there's still controversy on that too, whether or not everyone should be in one place or not.
Mm-hmm.
But at the very least, you need to be coordinating with the team. You need to be discussing and learning, because, I mean, that's why I started the podcast, because I don't see things the same way you do. I don't see things the same way an SLP does, the same way a body worker does, right? Like, I want to learn not to do your job, but to understand my job better. and to be able to explain to family and to be able to understand how dynamic this is and how it really does require more than just me or just you or just a body worker, like how it really, these families deserve the best, right? And these babies deserve the best chance at, you know, not just feeding, but at airway outcomes, right? So I'm always hesitant when I refer to a provider who doesn't do a lot of follow-up. That's always a red flag for me. It's like some of these newer places are like, yeah, they'll get you in, they'll see you tomorrow, they'll do it, but you don't have to send anything, you don't have to come back, it's all done, everything's great. How are they going to know how well their releases are doing? How are they really going to track outcomes and improve, right? Because all of us need to improve if they're not asking how well it's going, if they're not looking for signs of reattachment, if they're not even finding out to do anything. Is breastfeeding any better? You know, so that's always a big red flag. And that you do tend to see with those places popping up that are, you know, just doing phrenectomies and very trendy and sometimes also very expensive. You know, there's quite a range that I've seen, but there's definitely some that are very expensive.
And you should go out across country, you know, to see how things are done in many places. Which he practices and that sort of thing. Here in Canada, I guess we have a fee guide or a law provider, and I just follow the fee guide, you know, British Columbia fee guide when it comes to what will charge. But it's a guide. You can charge pretty much whatever you want. Charge less, more than the guide, and ultimately, you know, it, for us, it just makes it easier. It's a lot less guide because we do have insurance coverage that covers for these procedures.
Just my thoughts after family. Yeah.
So it's an extended medical benefits and dental benefits will cover for even when the babies don't even have a name yet. They're not even registered yet on the plan. It's just a matter of time, basically. We're trying to only purpose of that. Well, but we are very fortunate in Canada house coverage, at least in BC. I understand our friends in Ontario might have a little bit more difficulty getting dental coverage to cover for it, or we get covered, it's very minimal, or can't remember exactly how it was. Or was it OHIP, which is the Ontario Health, you know, benefits plan. So more government. Anyways, yeah, we have seen, you know, what we're practicing here. It's been helpful, you know, to have parents be able to afford to help with.
That is nice, like when we take out the financial decision and a procedure, because there's too many times that maybe it doesn't happen as much up here, but in the U.S., our medical decisions are very much guided by finance, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so many of the things that we really need are not covered.
Well, as an aside, unfortunately, in BC, the lactation consultant isn't covered. It's not much sure how it is, you know, Washington State or...
You know, I accept a couple of insurances, so sometimes get coverage. It really varies, but, you know, it's unfortunately, it's the way this world is going, at least in the U.S., that most, you know, a lot of families will say to me, they just consider their coverage for big emergency things, and everything else they really want and need is not going to be covered. So, well, I want to be really thoughtful of your time, because I know we're about to go see a client together, so I'm thankful for this time of yours and for being here with you today. So I just really want to thank you for getting the message out and for letting me come and meet with you today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change you. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast today and learned something new. If you know someone who would benefit from this podcast, please share.